Anon Radio.
Icecasting on AnonRadio.net.
Anon Radio.
Icecasting on AnonRadio.net.
Young complied, and while she was setting up a laser link to the communications relay satellite, by now, presumably somewhere among a growing fleet of ships that shared its orbit and the wormholes, I called up a display inside my helmet and did some rough editing of the suit's record of recent events. I made sure that Reed's most informative statements were there in full, so there'd be no doubt as to what he was saying. "Ready," Young's voice said. "Encrypted conference link. You'll all see the committee as a virtual view in your helmets, and they'll see our faces." Worried faces on both sides. "Are you all right?" Tetsuro asked. "We haven't had any contact for over an hour since you went into that tower." "We've been in a Faraday cage," I said. "We're all right. There's been an unexpected development. Tell you about it in a minute. How are things at your end?" Tetsuro massaged his eyebrows, leaving tiny paired dishevelments. "Fine, fine," he said. "The Jovians have finally managed to shut off the viral transmissions. That's at least a token of goodwill, but we aren't opening any radio channels just yet. Their own atmospheric traffic has started to increase again. Also, they've detected the incoming comet train. They can see it's heading for a slingshot orbit, but they raised the matter with every appearance of concern. Can't say I blame them. We've told them it's routine, for Martian terraforming. Showed them records of our previous cometary flybys, which they've checked against what they call Dreamtime archives. They seem reassured. Now about your position. The relay has detected and reported a buildup of ships on your side. What's going on?" It took me about 10 minutes to tell them, with clips of our discussion projected straight through from my suit to their screens. The consternation thus sown was almost amusing to watch. The angry, murmured discussions echoed and amplified our own. I concluded with my assessment of the odds. "Well," said Tetsuro when I'd finished, "this is certainly a complication. I would prefer that you had not said to Reed that his side's ships could come through. Is that not rather a matter for the Solar Council, or at least for its delegate?" "Oh," I said. I'd almost forgotten that little matter. The Solar Council delegate had, or represented, rather, the ultimate power over us. For all the Division's immense concentrated power, it could not prevail against the will of Earth and the inner system Earth defense forces. Not in the long run, not with attrition to consider. "Her fusion clipper has just gone into orbit around Callisto," Tetsuro continued, "with a few inner system fighters attached. Can we wait for the hour or so it will take for the delegate to arrive?" "The decision can't wait," I said. "Reed is selling the coordinates to the merchant fleet at this moment." Tetsuro shook his head reprovingly, but with a glint of wry amusement in his eye as he said, "You might have tried to argue for a delay of a little over a week." "We could still do that," I said. Suze raised her hand and spoke up. "If I may, neighbors, comrades, I don't think that would work. We're dealing with capitalists here. They'll expect us to stall and suspect us of stitching them up. That is, of doing our own deal with the Jovians and cutting their side out of it." "Which might not be a bad idea," said Clarity, frowning at us across light years and millennia. "Oh, it would," Sue said. "If I know anything about these people, they just batter on through. Race each other to be first to cut a deal. Their whole way of life is based on taking high risks for high returns." "And not much risk at that," I said sourly. "They've probably all taken backups, and they'll all try different approaches and keep on trying until one succeeds." "Or until the Jovians infect them all and turn them into puppets," said Young. "Puppets who can fight us in space." Tetsuro made a chopping gesture with his hand. "Whatever. I move that we let them through. I agree with Ellen's analysis. If what Young fears does happen, we are still in a better position to fight if our own forces are intact. However, I think we should insist that some of our own fighters go through the wormhole and take up positions on the new Martian side." "Opposed," said Joe Letterlow. "We shouldn't open the Solar Union to the bankers, and we shouldn't let them trade with the Jovians, who are still a danger to us." After a few more minutes of discussion, the vote was taken on letting the traders through. 8 in favor, 4 against. Tetsuro didn't pause for a second. "Carried," he said, as the hands went down. "So comrades, go and tell Reed his traders and fighters can come through, on the condition that our fighters can do the same. Let us know if he agrees or not." Obviously, you should make every effort to return to your ships. I appreciate why you had to leave them, but don't leave them for too long. Get your ships back into space if you can, and stand by for a bombing run. By yourselves or the other fighters, on the place where the Fast Folk templates are stored. And meanwhile... He looked around at the command committee, a slow, sly smile forming on his face. We'll work out how we're going to explain all this to the Solar Council delegate. Goodbye for now. I waved to the committee more bravely than I felt. Young switched out the link. Mally and Suze's voices were yelling in my ears. Tatsuro's passing comment was the first they'd heard about our real plans for the Fast Folk templates. I waved my arms frantically for silence. It's only a contingency plan, I shouted on the override. Only if Reed does something crazy with them. Don't look at me like that. We still can't trust them. Don't worry, Mally said grimly. I don't much care what happens to the templates. They're not conscious anyway. You can trust me not to tell. And me, said Suze. I just wish you had sooner. Her voice was thick with disillusion. I looked around at Mally, Suze, and the comrades, and as my glance slid helplessly from one blank bubble to the next, I realized that I couldn't tell which was which. All right, I said. I'm sorry. Now let's go and talk Reed into letting us do it. Before the World Commonwealth was established, one objection to it that always came up was, but who will do the dirty work? I always used to answer, me, and I was right. 10. In the Days of the Comet. One after another, the ugly, bristling, articulated fighter bombers came out of the wormhole. A whole squadron of them, their names heroic, ironic, or plain daft. Guy Fong, debug mode, virus alert, Luddite tendencies, Excalibur, Acquisitor, General Arnaldo Ochoa, codebreaker, and necessary evil but still cool. And one after another, the slow, laden freighters of the merchants and the fast, sharp fighters of their mercenaries went in. Even on the screen in the aerospace port, with the news child's prattling commentary jamming the silence, the sight remained awesome and uncanny. Ship after ship vanishing in a flash of blue light, as if annihilated. The same thought must have struck Andrea. What happened to the law of mass energy conservation? She asked. Did it just go away with those ships? Mally leaned over from the bench beside me. Good point, he said, jabbing his pipe stem like a lecturer's pointer at the screen. The answer is that the mass of the wormhole at this end increases, and at the other end decreases, by the same amount as has gone through. We were sitting with Reed and Dee in the same quiet area of the port where Boris and Jaime had waited. I watched the screen with silent satisfaction as our fighters took up positions around the wormhole and deployed a scatter of attitude control booster drones which clamped themselves around its perimeter. Reed had conceded this degree of control over the gate to us. I wasn't sure whether I'd convinced him it was the only way to get the people on our side to agree to his side's ships coming through, or whether his confidence in the superiority of capitalist technology made the entire concession irrelevant to whatever his longer-term plans might be. I was listening intently to the conversation and trying hard not to show it. Andrea was still puzzling over Mally's answer. So, she asked, does that mean one side of the wormhole would just fade away to nothing if enough mass came through from the other? In lay terms, said Mally cautiously, yes. But bear in mind that the mass can go negative. I leaned back, hands behind my head, gazing up through the roof, and tuned my tone to idle curiosity. What does that mean in physical terms? Mally laughed. I don't know, to be honest. The rest of the wormhole, the main wormhole, can balance a negative mass and thus keep the original gate open, up to a certain point. How much, though? Andrea sounded worried. Mally shrugged. Depends on its total virtual mass, which I don't know. A lot more than those ships, anyway. The gate on the other side masses 0.957 million tons, Dee said unexpectedly. On this side, a lot less, only about 100,000. If we keep up the traffic, we'll have to ensure that it balances. Unless we want to find out what negative mass means, in physical terms. We're safe enough for now, said Reed. The ships that went through probably don't mass more than 1,000 tons each. I don't see our side sending 20,000 tons the other way, I said with now easy flippancy. Ours are coming back. Reed glanced over at me and grinned, as though challenging me to deny it. aren't they? I returned him an equally unfriendly grin. Of course. The entire port was much quieter than it had been when we'd first arrived. The welcoming crowds had gone, and the heavy lifting had all been done. Only a few passengers, for the outlying settlements, I guessed, wandered or hastened through. Even the news remotes, with an appropriately gnat-like attention span, had drifted off. For the new Martians, it was the middle of the night. For us, early afternoon. Discarded disposable plates and the remains of likewise disposable food littered our surroundings. Now we were waiting for the autopiloted arrival of the terrible beauty and for the refueling of the carbon conscience to be completed. There was a certain amount of tension in the air and a lot of smoke. Mally was puffing his pipe, Dean Reed chain-smoking cigarettes. The habit seemed common in capitalist societies. If we had to wait much longer, I'd be tempted to take it up myself. What do you intend to sell and to buy? Suze asked. If I knew that, Reed said, I'd probably be doing it myself. The folks who are going through have given it a lot more thought than I have. He spread his hands. Information, I guess. They may get more information than they bargained for, Young told him, darkly. And you'll get it too. She stood up and paced forward and pointed at the screen. One of the defense agency fighters had hung back from going through and was deploying a relay drogue, much larger than ours, on the same alignment. I can't believe your complacency. I hope we get off this place before the Jovian viruses come down the line straight into your heads. Dee laughed. You don't get it, do you? She said. We do have open systems, yes, and we are personally vulnerable. I more than most, I should say, to mind hacking. That's exactly why we're not worried about it. We've had to develop countermeasures, very good ones, so we can protect ourselves from business competitors, criminals, or bloody kids. Young shrugged. Maybe so, she said doubtfully. But if you're up against conscious, well, supposedly conscious, entities with processing power vastly greater than yours, I can't see it doing much good. But we, Dee began. She looked at Reed. He shrugged. Oh, tell them, he said. They'll figure it out for themselves eventually. All right, Dee said. She stood up and faced us all as Young returned to her seat. I'll tell you. Her tone and her expression altered slightly, as though some different personality were in control. Consciousness, or the emulation of consciousness, if you insist, she smiled, her usual self flashing momentarily back. Costs. Selfhood has a very high cost in processing power, and that cost increases with the amount of information it has to integrate. It's not something that just drops out of increased complexity, as some people used to think. It has to be actively designed in, either consciously by us or unconsciously by natural selection. So it's quite possible to build hardware more powerful and software more complex than any brain or mind in existence. Computing machines that don't even act as if they're conscious, that don't have interests, and that don't object when they're used as tools. Her possession passed. Her self-possession returned. She stepped over to one of the long seats and expertly flicked the fluttery hem of her skirt under the crook of her knees as she sat down. I smiled at her. She and Reed had been right. No matter what I thought in the innermost depths of my mind, about the innermost depths of her mind, it was impossible to be with her, to converse with her, and not give her the benefit of the doubt, not act as if her mind had innermost depths. And not to quite simply like her. She smiled back. And these tools, Reed added, we have. That's why we're confident we can deal on equal terms with beings greater than ourselves. We have ways of amplifying our power to more than equal theirs. Golems to stand up for us against the gods. He crushed his cigarette and stood up. Products of good old capitalist competition. You should try it sometime. I found myself thinking of the great analytical engines of our socialist planning, whose spare capacities had increased over decades of stability in which more and more decisions had come to be made locally, and only the most general, those concerning the most widely used resources, had to be made globally or even regionally. I thought of our smart matter suits and our domestic cybernetics. Perhaps we'd all along had gods, or golems, on our side, whose aid it had never crossed our minds to invoke. About to say something of this, I looked at Reed and then tracked his gaze to a falling spark visible through the concourse's transparent roof. "Your ship's coming in," he said. "Time to go." Free at last. Free fall at last. It had taken hours, hours of shifting the ships and coupling them together, an awkward job in one gravity, half an hour of negotiation between Suze and one of Reed's employees over our debt to mutual protection, and another half hour with the port company over services they'd allegedly rendered and definitely wanted paying for, and finally a painful 5 minutes of boost to get ourselves quickly into this orbit. Reed's last words to me had been, "I hope I see you again." "Me too," I'd said. Sincere only in my hope that I never did. I unclipped my webbing, pushed myself away from the couch, and executed a joyous somersault, ending up just in front of the forward view. I hauled the gross focus bars of the display screen, rotated the fine focus handles. Although the wormhole was still a long way off on our slowly closing trajectory, the forward telescope's field, transmitted through lenses, mirrors, and fiber optic cables, showed our destination clear and sharp, the rainbow ring of the daughter wormhole, like its parent a mile across, and the glittering clutter of the surrounding ships. Our 10 fighters and Reed's one. Our relay drogue small, theirs large. I fiddled with the controls and swung in another view, an enhanced nighttime image of Ship City and its environs. "Okay, comrades," I called out, rolling around again. They'd all unstrapped and were flying around the command deck, enjoying not only the free fall, but the respite between getting out from under capitalism and having to face a bit of democratic accountability from our distant socialism. I grinned at them all and gave them a big thumbs up. "Mission accomplished, so far," I announced. "Yeah," said Mally. "And what did we accomplish?" "A lot," I said. "We've confirmed that the new Martians are just what they seem to be, real people, even if they do have funny ideas about what counts as people. We know for sure they're at risk of losing that if Reed or someone else gets too cocky about reviving his fast folk again. And from what that nice anarchist comrade Tamara told me, we have good reason to think the fast folk templates are still where Reed originally stashed them, up in the range of hills called the Madre Porite Mountains." I pointed it out and paused as a much more vivid marker made the point. A long bolide trail in the atmosphere and the flash of its impact. Another followed, and another. "That's it," I said above the sound of indrawn breaths. "There, near where they direct their comet fragments, at the source of that long channel leading into the city. We got the exact coordinates years ago, out of the artificial woman's, Meg's, data files. So if we or any of the other fighters gets the goal call, we can lob a nuke into the cave mouth and blast them and the whole mountain to blazes." "You've got nukes on this thing?" Mally asked indignantly. "On carbon conscience," Boris said. "That bird's got a 50-megaton Eggman. Nice, clean laser fusion job, in case you're worried."
"Consider me reassured," said Mally.
"No doubt a few 50-megaton city busters will come in real handy if the new Martians should have the bad luck to fall short of your definitions of what counts as people."
"There is that," Boris said thoughtfully.
"No," I said, shocked. "We're not going to do that."
"Why ever not?" Mally floated up, his voice heavy with sarcasm. "According to you, you wouldn't be killing people."
"Too dangerous," I explained. "Wouldn't be like Jupiter with vulnerable entities at the bottom of a gravity well. It'd be a massive breakout, with millions of ex-human puppets and a space-going capability. If there's another singularity here, we cut and run."
"Run where?" asked Andrea.
"Through the wormhole, if possible," I said. "And if not..." Mally hung in front of me, hanging on my words. I waved a hand airily in his face. "We keep boosting until we use half the reaction mass, back ourselves up if we absolutely have to, and at the first likely-looking clump of matter the ship finds, we download and spend the rest of the reaction mass decelerating."
And then, well, I smiled at his frown. "We have the makings of a nice little galactic empire of our own right here, with your beauty and my brains, neighbor."
Mally's anxiety dissolved in a guffaw.
"And I shall call you Eve."
"Mitochondrial Eve," Suze said firmly, catching Mally's hand.
"Plenty of good genes in the cold stores," said Boris.
I turned away before Mally could suspect there was even a sliver of a chance we were serious. But it was part of the standard kit of a fusion clipper, even so.
The haunting fear of a runaway torch, or of everything going wrong in our Cold War with the Jovians, was the real reason the ships relied on recycling rather than supplies, and stored the frozen seeds of a viable population and the smart matter blueprints for its infrastructure and technology in their vaults. "Enough," I said. "We got work to do. Jaime, Andrea, could you please haul yourselves over to the nav gear and the long-range viewing kit? We need to track all the moving matter around us, all the ships and missiles, and especially all the cometary junk. We don't want to wander into the path of their comet trains." "Indeed we don't," I thought to myself. "Don't worry about our deep space radar being pinged," I added. "They know we're here, and they know we're not hostile."
"We've paid for our protection," Suze reminded me.
"Handy stuff, Gold," I agreed. "And Young, I'd like you to help Andrea and Jaime with mapping comet streams. Their courses and timing must be public knowledge somewhere. As well as that, I need two channels, one to see if there's any readable information coming from their comms drogue."
"Newscasts, probably," Sue said. "Subscriber only, if I know them."
"So try subscribing," I said. Young grinned.
"And the other channel?"
"Same as before," I said. "Patch us into the command committee." I caught Mally's "you're in for it now" smile and smiled defiantly back. "Time to find out what the democratically elected delegate of socialist humanity thinks of what the heroic defenders of socialist humanity have been getting up to." I recognized the Solar Council delegate at once, which surprised me. As the Solar Council, like all the other councils from local to global, was directly elected, and I was theoretically one of its constituents, I shouldn't have been surprised. Local councils tended to be made up of people with local reputations, and so on up. The Solar Council's delegates should have been known to everyone in the solar system, usually for their decades, if not centuries, of good, competent work in relevant fields. The re-gerontocracy, as some of our younger and more cynical neighbors put it. But by and large, I trusted the people and the rest of the union to choose people whose previous experience and reputation they trusted. And now and again to throw in some absolute beginner who had made enough of a fuss about something to get their name bruited about. So, apart from my recently lost position on the Jovian Anomaly Research Committee, I generally stuck to my little intrigues in the division and left wider affairs alone. However, even I had heard of Mary Lou Radiation Nation Smith. She was, I think, Navajo, if it matters. In any case, a member of one of the all-too-many tribes. Aleutian, Kazakh, Aboriginal, Uyghur, etc., who'd been unwilling or unwitting participants in the old society's nuclear tests, and who now formed a loose but active lobby calling itself the Radiation Nation. They were united not by ethnicity, which the union only encouraged as a basis for cultural and definitely not for administrative association, but by a quite understandable, though I sometimes thought exaggerated, concern that we were a little too careless with our civil engineering and outbreak zapping and forest clearing nukes. "Yes," they'd say, "we can stop cancer and fix chromosomes and regenerate ecosystems, but there could be unknown losses, uncalculated risks." It was a legitimate point of view, despite all the mutterings about greens under the machines. And as a respected biologist and statistician, Mary Lou Radiation Nation Smith had the qualifications to back it up. Black bangs framed her face, dark eyes shone out of it. She was sitting beside Tetsuro, whose uncharacteristically frayed appearance, the hairs of his head, eyebrows, and mustache sticking out as if static-charged, contrasted with her well-groomed composure. "Ellen May Ngwethu," she said, as if it were the name of some particularly loathsome disease. "Comrades and friends." She swept us all with a glance, making a similarly distasteful diagnosis. "And the distinguished non-cooperator Dr. Malley. I'm pleased to meet you all at last, even at such a distance. Especially at such a distance, I should say. Your energy and enterprise are quite astonishing. We on the council had no idea you were planning such bold initiatives. Not only have you set up a scheme to destroy the Jovians, you've simultaneously entered into negotiations with them. No doubt you have already worked out what to do if these superhuman minds see through your highly plausible cover story and respond. I look forward eagerly to our surprise when you demonstrate your surefire, foolproof stratagem to prevent their entirely predictable fury from wiping us out. Don't spoil my suspense by telling me in advance. Not that telling us anything in advance is one of your habitual faults." She paused, placed the palms of her hands together and the fingertips under her chin. "Well," she said, I've heard the CC comrades' explanations. What do you have to say for yourself? Comrade, neighbor Radiation Nation Smith. Just call me Mary Lou, she said sweetly. Or neighbor Smith, if you prefer formality. My middle names are a sobriquet, like your last. From her point of view, it may have been an inappropriate reminder of just why I'd chosen that old slogan for my name. Ngwethu, freedom. I had it, and at the relevant point of application, perhaps more than she. The sting of her whiplash sarcasms faded, and embarrassing to relate, but there it is. A few half-forgotten bars of that haunting anthem Nkosi Sikelele Africa hummed through the back of my mind. Okay, Mary Lou, I replied. We in the division have a mandate to contain and destroy the outwarder threat, and that's exactly what we're doing. I've assumed all along that our actions would be accountable to the Union, and that if necessary, a global poll would be taken before the final decision. The issues are well known and have long been discussed, so there should be no problem. No problem, she said in a dead level tone. Of course, keeping our decision a secret from the Jovians is simply a matter of radio silence and complete self-discipline by billions of people, many of whom would be appalled at the suggestion of what you plan to do, not to mention what you've already done. You know, I can almost imagine that being possible, were it not for your other impressive feat. Opening contact and hostilities with the Jovians wasn't enough for you. She shook her head. Oh, no. As a final flourish, you manage, a mere hour before my arrival, to open the solar system to a vigorously expanding capitalist society. And an anarcho-capitalist one at that. I'm sure if you'd had the choice between New Mars and some tedious status tyranny, with whose tedious status tyrants we could at least have made some kind of deal that might actually stick, you'd still have picked New Mars, out of pure scientific curiosity as to which anarchy would subvert the other first. Let me tell you that your curiosity may be well justified. Dr. Malley. Malley jumped, in as much as one can in free fall, like a student caught dozing in a lecture. Yes? I'm in no position to remonstrate with you. As a non-cooperator, you can't be expected to live by our rules. However, you do have to live with the consequences of your actions. Here are some consequences of yours. After decades of virtual radio silence from Earth, your brave experiment in encouraging your students to make and use radios has led to something of a happy babble of electronic communication. Our non-co friends heard that I was on my way out here and decided to spread the news to the handful of non-cos in space. You'd be surprised to learn how much ill-informed comment on my well-known concerns has flashed around the solar system in the last few days. Evidently, the new Martian traders have monitored it closely. Not difficult, because in absolute terms, there isn't much radio traffic. Yet. A couple of hours ago, I received a personal message from one of these ships, offering me an unrepeatable ground floor offer, whatever that is, for an import concession. I know what that is, thank you. For alpha emitter assimilating biomechanisms, whatever they may be. How did you respond? Asked Malley with what I thought commendable nerve. I told them to shop off, was the somewhat coarse reply. However, we shortly afterwards picked up another version of the same offer beamed towards Earth for anyone who cares to take it up. It's one of thousands of similar propositions directed at Earth, which in turn are the merest fraction of the communications going on between the traffickers' fleet and Jupiter. Most of the latter are heavily encrypted, so we don't even know what the offers they're making are. None of this came as a surprise, but it was all happening faster than I'd expected. I hadn't foreseen that the inevitable contact between the dominant non-cos of New Mars and the marginal non-cos of Earth would result in so much information leakage that keeping our plans from the Jovians would be well nigh impossible. All right, I said. I see your point. That just means we'll have to act first and take the vote later. That's if most people aren't so relieved to be rid of the Jovian threat that it'll be obvious to anyone what the majority view is. Mary Lou Smith lost her expression of detached, ironic appraisal. She shot me a look of hot fury. Act first, vote later, she said. On an issue like this, what a disgusting attitude to your fellow human beings. It isn't my attitude, I protested. It's what's required by the realities of the situation.
Yes, realities which you've brought about.
For a moment, she looked as if she were about to start banging her head on the table. Then she drew her shoulders back and took a deep breath.
Enough, she said. We must deal with the situation as it is and uncover the reasons for this mess when we have time. The whole relationship between the Union and the Division has to...
She stopped herself, stood up, and took a few steps backwards so she could see all of the committee as well as all of us.
As I say, enough. Here's what I propose to transmit to the Solar Council, and what, on my mandate from the Solar Council, I instruct you to implement immediately, pending the Council's decision. 1. You absolutely must not provoke the Jovians by giving them any reason whatever to fear a cometary bombardment. That means you must divert the comet train into a wider and irreversibly safe orbit now. 2. You must step up fighter-bomber patrols on this side of the wormhole and make no compromises with the new Martians on that. We have to make clear to them that they're here on our sufferance. 3. You must prepare to jam all radio transmissions within the Jovian subsystem and between it and the inner system, whether from the Jovians, the new Martians, or the Noncos. She strode forward and sat down again. That is all, she said. Any questions? Nobody said anything. Quickly scanning the faces of the others on the committee, I registered that most of them showed nothing but relief. In the case of Clarity and one or two others, more than relief. I took in their tentative smiles, keeping my own face carefully neutral. Only Joe Lutterlow showed anger, which he was equally visibly restraining. Tatsuro looked at me gravely. The tiny down tilt of his head could have been a cryptic nod or an unconscious bowing to the inevitable. Mary Lou might not have much immediate power to bring to bear on us, but a greater constraint applied. The Division couldn't go against the explicit will of the Union, or even of its authorized delegate, without being irretrievably split. And if we tore ourselves apart, we risked being easy prey for the enemy. Well, if the others were too intimidated to talk, I was not. You propose a risky course, I said. We've taken some risks too, I admit, but we always had the final failsafe of the comet strike to fall back on. Anything conceded to the Jovians or the new Martians could still be negated with that. Now you want to strike this weapon from our hands and leave us defenseless. Smith jumped to her feet and leaned forward, fists on the table.
Ellen May and Gwethu, she shouted. I've had enough of your inflexible attitudes. I've heard more than enough of your devious speeches. I've had it up to...
She stopped. Leaned back, drew breath. She bowed her head for a moment and massaged her temples, then looked up at me and smiled. Excuse my outburst, neighbor. I understand your situation better than you do. You've endured 2 centuries of apparently endless conflict. 2 centuries for your personal dislikes to rankle into hatred. You've had even longer for the harshest aspects of the true knowledge, its dark side, if you will, to overwhelm its truth. Because the truth is the whole, and in raising the aspect of struggle way out of proportion to that of cooperation, you've turned it into a lie. If you could see yourself, as I have, I've had time to sample the records of this committee and those which you and your comrades have been sending back. In all your implacable belligerence, your imperviousness to the reasonable appeals of rational beings, whether the Jovian speaker or the new Martian gynoid, to be recognized as such. If you could see all that... I hope there is still something in you that would be ashamed. I stared at her, shaken despite myself. I've done nothing out of personal malice. Nothing I'm ashamed of, and nothing that goes against the true knowledge. Mary Lou shook her head slowly. There are 2 sides to the true knowledge, and you have forgotten one of them despite your name. There is not only Amandla, power, there is also Ngwethu. Freedom. I know that, I said calmly, and we'll lose both if we throw away our last chance to destroy the Jovians while we still can. For a split second, Mary Lou literally staggered as though I'd hit her. Then she said, All right. Let me speak to you in a language you understand. We are not throwing away our last chance to destroy the Jovians. There never was a chance. As soon as a stable, reality-oriented Jovian culture emerged, there was no chance that it could be destroyed by anything we could throw at it.
These are beings whose evolutionary ancestors disintegrated Ganymede and punched a hole through space. How many hours do you think it would take for them to develop some response that could swat aside your comets like flies? And as soon as you brought back the first pictures and the first messages, there was not a chance that the people of the Union would react to the Jovians' emergence with anything but hope, and to their destruction with anything but horror. You've seen how a typical Union member, Suze, a typical tough-minded non-co, Dr. Malley, and even your own command committee have reacted. They've all drawn back from the brink to varying degrees, and they're right. Our only chance of survival is to survive with them. And the only effect of attempting to destroy them would be to make them the deadly enemies you seem to take for granted they are. She turned to Tetsuro. Which reminds me, she said. I heard no dissent from my instruction except from Ellen. Do you wish to take a vote? Tetsuro nodded wearily. Those for accepting the delegate's instructions. All the hands on the other side went up, except Joe's. Those against? Me and Joe. I smiled at him. He shook his head, lips compressed in a thin line, and drew a finger across his throat. I don't think anyone else saw the gesture. Behind me, I distinctly heard Young say, "Shit." No one else spoke. "Carried," said Tetsuro. He took his control panel from its strap around his neck and jabbed in a long series of firing codes. "It's done," he told Mary Lou. "The jets are firing, the nukes are flaring. The cometary masses have been shifted to the orbit you requested." "Let me confirm that," she said. "No offense, neighbor." She spoke briefly and quietly into a personal phone, waited a few seconds, then nodded. "Okay," she said. "The local observatories have confirmed it." Her shoulders moved as though a weight had been lifted from them. "And now," she said, "Ellen, let me try to reassure you about the Jovians." My heart was thudding, my mouth dry. She sat down on the edge of the table, leaning on one hand, twisting her body a little to face me in a pose of casual conversation. "They're not monsters, you know. Why should you expect beings more powerful and intelligent than ourselves to be worse than ourselves? Wouldn't it be more reasonable to expect them to be better? Why should more power mean less good?" I could hardly believe I was hearing this. Glancing quickly over my shoulder, I saw Andrea, Jaime, and Young working at their screens but listening intently, and the rest giving Mary Lou all their attention. I searched for my most basic understanding and dragged it out. "Because good means good for us." Mary Lou smiled encouragingly and spoke gently, as though talking someone down from a high ledge. "Yes, Ellen. But who is us? We're all human, post-human, non-human. Machines with minds in a mindless universe, and it behoves those of us with minds to work together if we can in the face of that mindless universe. It's the possibility of working together that forges an us, and only its impossibility that forces a them. That is the true knowledge as a whole, the Union and the Division." She laughed. "So to speak. In fact, exactly so. The Union and the Division." Images of the Jovians and all their multifarious forms processed through my mind. My skin felt as if small, chill, unpleasant things were crawling over it. I remembered the cold, lively metal of the robots, the warm flesh of Dee's fingertips, and I knew that my response to those machines, however edgy, however suspicious, however prejudiced it might be, was not the same as my cold, intellectual loathing of the Jovians. Beautiful though they were. The robots and the gynoid and all their kind, conscious or not, had become part of us. Whereas the Jovians... "You mean you would contemplate a union with them?" Mary Lou nodded briskly. "Of course, with those who wanted to. You may not know this, but the Jovians have the true knowledge, in their own terms. Some of their practices are even socialist." "God help us all," I thought, heretically. "That," I said, "only makes them more dangerous. More powerful because more united, like we're dangerous to them, or were, until you people..." I stopped my words too late. Mary Lou chopped her hand downwards.
She pushed herself off the table, a slow, graceful motion in Callisto's low gravity, and brushed her hands together as if to remove some light dust. "That's it," she announced. "End of discussion. If we are now you people, then we aren't in any kind of union with you. I have nothing more to say to you, Ellen. Go away. Just keep out of trouble. Don't make any more trouble for us. And let someone else sort out your head, because I won't. Goodbye." She raised her hand above her shoulder, glanced at Tatsuro, and snapped her fingers impatiently. Tatsuro gave me a last helpless look, reached for something out of sight, and the screen went dead. It was all down to me now, I thought. Time for Plan B. I rolled in the air and grabbed a stanchion. The comrades and Mally were all staring at me, or at the blank screen. The command deck had never sounded so quiet. "So that's it, I guess," I said. "And very glad I am," said Mally. Suze looked at him, looked at me, and nodded. "It's over," she said. "Come on, Ellen. The decision's made. The die is cast. The comets won't crash, and Mary Lou's won the committee to her way. All right, there are risks, but she's right. There'd be more risks in yours. We'll just have to accept it and hope they made the right choice." "Hope," I said. Hope was there, lighting up the eyes of Suze and Mally. The faces of the five other comrades didn't show hope, nor share the dread I felt. They were lost in their own thoughts, the worst of which may have been that they might have to choose between me, between us, the team, and the Union, or even the Division. For all our fierce individualism, we'd all, consciously or not, drawn strength from the Union, not only in the obvious objective sense, but also in ourselves. Mary Lou had been right about that, at least. Good for us had two sides. Now I'd have to work with this feeling, get it on my side, and so on everybody's, whether they knew it yet or not. "Nothing's over," I said. "We have not been expelled from the Union, or even from the Division, and whatever Mary Lou may think, I'm still on the command committee until I hear otherwise." I waved behind me at the blank screen. "If the comrades choose to throw me out, fine. The first thing they'll do is tell us." "They haven't. Until they do, I'll carry on as a member." Mally scowled, Suze shrugged, the others brightened slightly. "Okay," I went on. "There's something I have to tell you. For a long time now, Tatsuro and I have had an understanding. We both knew things might come to this, and we knew we'd need a fallback position if even the comet strike were struck out." I smiled and coaxed some flickers of response. "Whether by the Jovians or by our own decision, we knew we might come to that decision. We knew we might even agree with it ourselves. We weren't, I wasn't, as dogmatic about the Jovians as Mary Lou made out. I was the first to argue for attempting contact, remember, against a fair bit of opposition."
"Come off it," snapped Mally. "That was just to get my cooperation."
"Of course," I said, "but it was hardly an act of blind hatred, was it? I risked my own mind making the first contact. You know how I feel about backups, and whatever you may think of that view, it's sincerely held. The risk was real to me. I trusted them enough to take their path through the wormhole, a risk we all shared, yes, but I sure wouldn't have taken it if I thought the Jovians were monsters."
"You've made your point," said Mally. "So why didn't you make it to Mary Lou?"
"I know a hopeless fight when I see one," I said. I shrugged. "She has her point of view, fair enough, but I think she's biased towards a nonviolent resolution and blinded to the other possibilities. Don't get me wrong, nothing would please me more than to find that she's right, that we and the Jovians can coexist and cooperate and so on, that they won't turn out as bad or mad as their predecessors. But until I'm convinced of that, until we all know we're safe, I'm going to do my best to ensure that we do have a last resort. Only as a last resort, and only if it's them or us, and everyone for themselves. And it's one that won't threaten, won't even worry the Jovians, until or unless they threaten us." Jaime and Andrea glanced at the screens at which they'd been working, then smiled at me with dawning comprehension. "This is what Tatsuro and I agreed," I went on. "The real reason we came here. Because here we have comet trains all set up for us. Ones the Jovians need never see and which can strike at them without warning. We can send comets through the wormhole."
"But the comets aren't," Tony began.
Mally shot him a dry smile, and to me, one of grudging respect. Very elegant, he said. Relative motion. Yes, I said. We're going to move the wormhole. It wasn't as simple as that, but the process of setting it up convinced the comrades that at some level I still had authorization for what I was doing. And I had, inasmuch as Tetsuro and I had indeed privately agreed on this contingency plan before I'd even set out to find Wild O'Malley. The fact that the division's fighter bombers around both ends of the wormhole responded to my requests was evidence enough, not least to myself, that I hadn't been thrown off the command committee. Not yet, anyway. I sat beside Young while she sent the encrypted instructions to the squadron on our side and to the Turing tester on the other. The action of the latter was crucial, but it passed almost unnoticed in the general redeployment of fighter bombers around the Mallee Mile, on which, ironically enough, it was Mary Lou who had insisted. The Turing tester pulsed its own instructions to the wormhole gate's attitude control rockets, which fired off in a sequence of brief puffs. Slowly, over several hours, almost imperceptibly, the great rainbow ring swiveled on its axis to face the surface of Jupiter. Meanwhile, we drifted closer and closer to the daughter wormhole gate. Neither our fighters nor the lone autopiloted sentry, which, I was amused to note, actually did belong to Reed's Mutual Protection Company, challenged us. Jaime and Andrea steadily mapped the incoming stream of cometary fragments, which fell almost hourly on uninhabited parts of New Mars after perhaps decades of slow, directed infall from this system's equivalents of the Kuiper Belt or Oort cloud. We calculated that we could reach a sufficiently high speed to make an effective bombardment within anything from 30 minutes to 2 hours, with the ship dragging the wormhole at up to 30 G if we had to pick the shorter approach. The maximum tolerable acceleration for that length of time, even with full use of the support capacity of our smart matter suits. How do we grab the wormhole? Mallee asked. It's been done before, I said. It's set up. The little attitude control drones were designed for the original orbital shift we gave the Mallee Mile back home. They clamped around it, and they have secondary clamps that can grab onto the ship's lifting gear cables. We can do it. The gate will be tilted at an acute angle behind us. We'll be at its center of gravity, and our jet will be firing into it, going... I raised my eyebrows. Mallee shrugged.
Who knows?
Just before the encounter, we'd have to cut the drive, disengage from the wormhole's perimeter, and fire the drone's attitude jets to fine-tune the angle of the wormhole, so that the comets would follow the same course as had the departing ships, and explode out of the other side on a straight course for the surface of Jupiter. The combined velocities of the daughter wormhole gate and the comet fragments would deliver enough kinetic energy to spread devastation for tens of thousands of miles around their points of impact. It would be best if we could simultaneously get the ships on the other side to move the far mouth of the wormhole, sweeping it like a gun muzzle across Jupiter, and preferably on a course that would take it all the way round, but we couldn't count on that best-case scenario. Nor could we count on the configuration lasting for a Jovian 9-hour day, carrying the exit gate around the planet. What we could count on was hitting the Jovians hard. Young had found several commercial channels and several internal company reporting channels, which were either not encrypted or easily hacked. We kept our forward lasers trained on the new Martian's comms drogue. We stayed near our acceleration couches, watched the screens, and waited. Hours passed. I was keeping an eye on a narrowband monitoring channel, relayed from a camera and a mic in an upper corner of a room in a ship. Not encrypted, nothing special. Full color, sleety image, monosound, trickle feed. Probably just one of those capitalist things, management spying. Maybe something more benign, a sort of online black box. It was certainly not that ship's main comms channel, which was sending back an unbreakable flood of coded data. It showed a constant, unwavering view from inside one of the trading vessels. Its command deck, by the look of it. Much less cluttered than ours, no recycling equipment, none of the trailing tubes and climbing tendrils. 5 acceleration couches, molded and resilient and glistening, like black jellies. 4 men and a woman in identical blue fatigues drifting around, checking instruments, watching their outside screens, joking and chatting. They didn't seem to have much to do. They were excited about being in the solar system. One man had been there before, which gave me an eerie feeling when it became clear from his conversation that he'd been one of the uploaded slave mines and the Outwarder's construction robots. The real work of their mission was being carried on by their ship's computer, which they referred to as the Bitch, apparently in honor of the ship's name, which was Running Dog. I was not as bored as they were, partly because of my still simmering tension, and partly because, As generations of producers of visual wallpaper have shown, there's something hypnotically watchable about people in space, just as there is about watching planetary surfaces from space. Snatches of conversation picked up by that unobtrusive mic, narrowcast to a nearby drogue, lasered at a critical angle into the wormhole, cutting through millennia of space and time, bounced to another relay beamed by radio to, no doubt, some bored watcher on New Mars, picked up by Young's eavesdropping aerials to finally be heard by me.
Bitch is hot!
Yeah, man, she's got her tail up now. Must have met another Jovian. Meeting of minds. Sniff, sniff. Laughter. Reds still around the mile? Like flies on a shit. Don't like it, man, don't like it at all. Home says not to worry. Don't trust them, but fuck, it's their territory.
Says who?
Home, that's who. We don't know what they can do, yet, anyway.
No, I thought, you don't.
Not a whole hell of a lot, not if they're like the commies we used to know and love.
Ha ha, didn't know you were that old.
Looked good on the tail, though. See the tall black one?
Yeah.
Ribald noises. About me, I realized, and felt flattered. The men rolled and somersaulted, trading ineffectual pokes and punches. Then a voice cut across their laughter, the woman's voice, like a dash of cold water.
Something's wrong.
What?
Look at the board, what the fuck?
Bitch, are you all right?
Bitch!
They were diving backwards to their couches, which caught and embraced them in swiftly emerging pseudopods of glassy black jelly. As soon as they'd smacked into place, the five astronauts were working very hard, very fast. I could see their heads move, tracking virtual head-ups, their fingers flex over invisible keys. My own movements were almost a reflex of theirs. I was yelling, patching the view from this channel into the other screens and tiling in theirs. On a news channel, one of the merchant ships, which a sidebar swiftly tagged as the running dog, had begun to move strangely, yawing under irregular thrusts from its attitude jets.
They seem to be having some...
A child's puzzled voice.
Boris, I shouted. Forward laser now, get ready to hit the comms drogue. Young, screen out all encrypted input now. Andrea, warm the torch.
The voices of the running dog's crew were still coming through.
Can't raise the bitch, can't raise the bitch.
Shut up,
we're trying. Shit. Drive's not responding. Running dog to home, we got a bad situation here. Engine out. Bitch haywire, we're getting sort of rolling motion, irregular. Say again, please. Shit. Comms are out.
Lights are on, nobody's home.
Ha ha.
Running audit now.
Okay, guys, we're in deep shit here, deep shit. Bitch seems to have taken a massive data hit. She's down.
No, she's running.
The hell she is, she's not. Oh, fuck. Gotta report this. Shit! Comms are still out! Hey, the monitor!
Faces turned, looking straight at me. If anyone's getting this, the woman's voice said, quite calmly, please act fast. We think our onboard computer has been hacked into and taken over.
A fucking Jovi's uploaded on us!
Another voice yelled, and meanwhile, in the background, a third voice was intoning.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us now at the hour of our... Hey, wait a minute, guys! Everything's back to normal! It's cool, look!
As I watched, their expressions changed from frantic concern to calm relief. The woman was making waving motions at the monitor.
Cancel that, she said urgently, smiling. False alarm, sorry folks, false alarm. Electrical glitch. Jovian atmosphere storm, that's all. Panic over.
The men behind her were moving in a completely different way than they had before. Heads and arms working away in a new virtual space. There was nothing wrong with their movements, except that they were all making the same movements in unison. Four heads turned as one, smiling at the monitor as their hands reached and fingers flexed in their synchronized puppet ballet.
Boris, I said.
On the forward view, the twirling parasol of the new Martian's comms drogue flared at the focus of our lasers and flash-burned instantly to a million fragments of twinkling foil. Andrea hit the drive as all the other screens went out. It wasn't a long burn, just enough to kick us into a closing orbit with the gate. We had only a few minutes in which to act. Lots of things seemed to happen at once.
Enemy fighter spinning around, Boris announced calmly. Firing. Missile launched and closing. Active defense.
The forward view lit up with a big flash, then lots of small ones as the active defense lasers mopped up the missile's fragments.
Fighter taking evasive action. I'm realigning the laser. Over to automatic fire.
Target destroyed. He thought about it for a second and added,
Yeehaw! What did they attack us for?
Suze demanded.
For burning the drogue, I said.
Should be grateful. Jaime was running a plot on the nearest comet train, and Andrea was aligning the ship to match his calculation. Our attitude jets fired again and again, sending us on a giddying roll. Young passed the data to the fighter bombers, and the necessary evil but still cool sent its own message to the gate's little attitude control jets. By the time we were ready to dock with the gate, it was lying at an odd angle, apparently below us like a tilted plate, and we were sliding backwards above its mile-wide face. On some screen, I noticed, out of the corner of my eye, that our small comms drogue was darting about like a flea on a griddle, squandering its fuel in a mindless attempt to hold the correct position, relative to the disc of the gate for picking up the division's messages. Zap it too? No, I was confident, even now, that the division's computers and comms weren't going to fall for the Jovian outbreak. The ship was now lined up for a straight blast into a course to intercept the comet train and to continue along up that infall orbital path. The hull shuddered repeatedly as the grappling lines were fired. They snaked out and were snared by the perimeter clamps. Andrea played another subtle but sickeningly violent crescendo on our own attitude jets, adjusting our alignment as the lines took the strain of the gate's mass. 100,000 tons, Dee had said. Plus another 20,000 for the score of ships that had sailed through it on their bright, bold Enterprise. And had encountered at least one entity which had found the temptation, or competitive necessity, of getting in first as powerful as theirs. I thought of Dee and wondered how her vaunted competitive countermeasures were holding out against whatever had come down the line from the poor, possessed running dog. Doing better than I expected, I hoped, for my sake, and hers, I realized, in a sudden pang of anguished solidarity with a self that, human or not, was at least as singular as mine. Holding position, Andrea said. General Arnaldo Ochoa to Terrible Beauty. Young was patching the message through to my phones. The voice was almost languid. Situation back home severely compromised. Situation here totally confusing. Please advise. Whoever that was had the right stuff all right. I cut in the override on the division's all-ships channel. Hi, guys and gals. Terrible Beauty here. Situation as follows. At least one new Martian merchant ship with crew has been taken over by a Jovian upload or personality copy. That is confirmed. Repeat, confirmed. Comms drogue destroyed by us to stop viral spread. We don't, repeat, do not know if we did this in time. Observe extreme caution with all incoming comms of new Martian origin. We are about to blast off with Wormhole Gate in tow. Intend to try punching local comet train through to hit Jupiter. You have 2 minutes to get clear or attempt to return home. The languid voice returned. Thanks for the clarification, Terrible Beauty. Good luck. We see heavy fighting back home. All ships have been recalled. We're leaving. Do you wish continued updates from our own comms drogue? Yes, shouted Young, the sheer volume of her voice carrying it to my override. Patching you through. The scene, relayed from the home system by the, for now, stable and on-position drogue, flashed up on the virtual screens of the suits, which were still tensing and hardening around us. It came from an external camera on the Turing tester, loyally on station in front of the gate. Jupiter was bang in the middle of the view, as I'd hoped. The rest of the view sparkled with the flashes of distant laser hits and was scored by the scorch of particle beams and snowed by the chaff thrown out in efforts to deflect or diffuse both. Missile trails and kinetic energy tracers added to the battle's blaze. Two or three of the trading vessels were in sight, each surrounded by a swarm of fighters. One was heading away on what looked like an entirely orthodox evasion course. The others were wallowing in the same bizarre way as the running dog had when its systems were first suborned. I could almost feel the strivings of the new minds in their unfamiliar frames, new impulses racing through controls, and the struggles of whatever parts of the ship's programming resisted its new master. The ship's yaw and pitch were resultant of these conflicting forces. Through the whole confused scene flitted the dark shapes of our own fighter bombers, their violent maneuvers dodging at least the